Hi, listeners. Lady P here. I'm just giving a brief introduction to try and explain the tenor of today's show. It was recorded prior to the election last Tuesday, and that kind of explains the jovial tone when we address issues like race and kind of the intersectionality of the American media and stuff like that. Just various racial issues are brought up, and we kind of, the way we address it is kind of, and it now seems very naive and kind of maybe insensitive. You can listen and let me know if what your reaction is. I'm very curious to hear. And yeah, just generally very eager to hear your thoughts on this episode. So please, please reach out on Twitter and Facebook or wherever. And yeah, Martin is actually here with me. Martin, say hi.
Hello. Hi.
Yeah. And Marcus Pinn is on this episode as well. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here this evening.
Dropped out.
Oh, no, Martin. Martin was here.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you.
Okay.
Yeah, Martin was here. He's back, it seems. Martin, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I mean, I still stand by opinions that come up during the episode. Hopefully, people still find value in the conversation. Yeah.
I think everything that we said still stands. It's more just... There's a lot.
Just more so,
yeah, but... only more so. Exactly. Yeah, there's a even greater gravity to what to our thoughts. I think. And you can enjoy the
all over again. It would just be much more somber.
Exactly. Exactly. So kind of like my tone right now. This is an internet platform. Usually we use it to talk about movies. But tonight, as I record this with my good friend Martin, I just want to take a second to say I am appalled and embarrassed and sad for the American public. And I just hope we can move on from this and kind of galvanize ourselves into just creating positive change. And like, I just hope this isn't too much of a discouragement for people who are new to political action. And it's terrible. I'm still trying to find a silver lining in all of this. I'm slowly coming around to the idea that it has awakened me from my complacency. I guess that's about it. And that I have been able to reach out to friends. And just it's a good reminder of, you know, that we have to keep loved ones close. I don't know, Martin, anything else you wanted to add?
No, nobody wants to know what I have to say.
Get out of here, Canadian. Jesus. Well, I hope you are making room on your couch, because I imagine you will have... Yeah, like what Canada needs to be a place of refuge should the worst go down.
We're next. I'm renewing my passports as we speak.
Really. Booking it out of here. We're all going to Australia. that is the wrong attitude, I know. But I just, and the truth is, like, this can happen anywhere. And it's important to be diligent and to speak out when you can. And without further ado, enjoy our episode on Story of a Three-Day Pass. Bonjour, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P. Or at least that's what the voices in the mirror tell me. No relation to Master P. And joining me today is a man who enjoys long beach weekends with total strangers, Mr. Marcus Pinn.
Hello.
And joining me today is FlixWise co-producer, cardigan-wearing white man, Mr. Martin Kessler.
I think something got lost in translation there.
Yeah, a little bit. okay, so listeners, did you know that the best French New Wave movie was actually made by an American? On today's show, we have yet another FlixWise favorites entry. Martin Kessler is going to tell us why Melvin Van Peebles' debut feature, Story of a Three-Day Pass, is one of the greatest films of all time. Martin, tell us what Story of a Three-Day Pass is and why people should watch it.
Okay.
That's this is probably like the shortest intro I've ever given you. Sorry, guys.
That's okay. Story of a Three-Day Pass is about Turner, a black American soldier played by Harry Baird, who is stationed in France. And after being given a three-day pass by his captain, meets and falls in love with a French woman named Miriam, played by Nicole Becher. There's much sweetness in the time they spend together, but also bitterness too, especially in the form of racial prejudice. And it all leads to an emotionally complicated ending. It's an anomalous film in many ways. Like you said, it's a French New Wave film directed by an American. So already its perspective is unusual and... I don't know, it's warm, melancholic, poignant, honest, bold, sensitive, poetic, lots of adjectives. I think it's such an amazing film. I think people should talk about this film. It should be everywhere. I think it's amazing.
Okay.
Sorry, I kind of...
No, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's a good reason why people should watch it, because it's bold and amazing. So let's tell the story of how this podcast came about. I think it was one of the very first interactions we ever had was you suggesting this movie for the FlixWise favorites list. I think you mentioned that you had emailed me back in August 2014, which at this point is a while ago. So I don't know what my problem is. I don't know why I kept putting it off. But having said that, now having watched it, I am so glad that you suggested it, because you're so right. It is such a bold, fun, special movie, you know? But Marcus, how did you come to Story of a Three-Day Pass?
On the, this was years ago, the IFC channel, they used to screen that documentary that Mario Van Peebles, I'm not sure if he just hosted it or directed it. Rated X by an all-white jury. I think that's the name of the documentary. And they, up until that point, all I knew was Sweet Sweet Back On.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of film sites were around, say, you know, 2003, 2004. So I didn't really look him up like that. And then there was this quick snippet of his early work. It was, you know, Watermelon Man and Story of a Three-Day Pass. You know, they were discussing Melvin Van Peebles' work. And it was that shot. It was that Steadicam shot that Martin knows that you see in Story of a Three-Day Pass, where they're at the dance, the party, and he goes over to try to dance with the with the woman. And I just remember that quick scene. I was like, oh, that looks like maybe something Spike Lee borrowed. And then aside from that, I was like, wow, that's a really great shot. Also, it was such a quick moment. The actor, Harry Baird, it looked like Herbie Hancock for some reason. And I was like, oh, did Herbie Hancock make a movie with Melvin Van Peebles? You know, so I searched it out, I found it, watched it, and I loved it. And I own it on DVD, and yeah, I've loved it ever since.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe now is a good time to talk about Melvin Van Peebles. Who are we talking about? for those who are unfamiliar, this is definitely not his best known work.
No, it's definitely not. At least, I don't think so.
Yeah, but let's talk about what he's most famous for and how this has seeds of that work, but
sure.
It's also very different. Yeah, who wants to take that one, Marcus?
He's a maverick DIY, you know, indie filmmaker. He's also just an interesting human being, to say the least. I think, you know, like we're saying, he's most known for this film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which kind of, it spearheaded a couple of things, but mainly just the blaxploitation genre, which, you know, it inspired a couple of good movies, but then, you know, towards the mid late 70s, black exploitation just became a joke. But, you know, he's a very influential filmmaker. Mostly he gets credit for being an influential filmmaker in terms of, like, you know, black cinema, but in terms of indie film too, I think those who know. But generally speaking, when you think of, you know, American independent film, it's always named first, obviously John Cassavetes comes to mind, then maybe Shirley Clark, people like that. But I think he's just as important, you know, as them. So, but to sum it up, he's a important American indie filmmaker. So.
Okay.
Yeah, if you're into independent filmmaking, he's a great role model. Like, he talks about in 1957 trying to make his first feature film and not knowing anything about filmmaking. So, like, he bought the film to make, like, a 90-minute feature. And, you know, as he went along, so, oh, you have to cut it, and, oh, you can't cut the negative, and, oh, you have to do sound. And so, like, it ended up becoming an 11-minute short. But, like, that's such a great way to learn about the process of filmmaking. And, and he talked about, like, screening it under his son's crib, because that was the dark place in his home, reading Eisenstein's essays. He was self-taught. He was, I guess he made a number of short films in America, and he sort of used those to try and get a job in Hollywood. But I think especially then, being a black filmmaker, it wasn't difficult to get into Hollywood. It was impossible. Like, there was no...
Yeah.
You couldn't. So, like, I think he said they offered him a job as an elevator operator, and...
How generous.
So, like, where do you go? You go to Europe. So
he
went to, I think he went at first to Holland, where he was studying mathematics and astronomy, but he was also doing, he did a play for the Dutch theater, which I just found out, and I thought that was really interesting. But eventually his short films got him attention in France, and sort of brought him to France, where mostly he was a writer. I think he wrote a number of novels in French. Story of a Three Pass. I think it's based on his fifth French language novel, La Permission. So he's mostly, I think they're known as a writer. He was translating Mad magazines. He was, I think, like they said, in France, one thing that made his perspective so valuable is because he was an outsider, he was writing a lot of French stories, but I think, I forget who, somebody in the documentary How to Eat Your Watermelon in White Company and Also Enjoy It said, like, his perspective was valuable because it was seeing France through the eyes of a Martian. You know, he was sort of, and, like, I think that definitely comes through in this film, the sort of way he observes people and situations and things that might seem normal. Like, he gives sort of a special attention to certain details that might be glossed over by other French filmmakers. And the style of the film, it's so interesting to see. Like, it very much is a French New Wave film, the way it's cut. Like, you know, you can put this right up against a Godard film or whatever, and, like, it fits in. But it's also mostly in English, and it's about an American, and it's sort of, it's an American voice just coming through in this French New Wave style. And you look at all the people involved. Like, I think the cinematographer, what's his name? I think it's Michael Kelber, right? Maybe
I didn't look,
but, like, I was checking. He was, I think it's Michael Kelber, maybe. But I know he shot films, like, since the 30s, like, for a lot of French impressionist films. He worked with Jean Renoir. He shot Josephine Baker in Zuzu. Like, you know, he's working with people that were, like, all over. And Nicole Bergère, of course, who acts in the film, like, she was kind of a staple of French New Wave filmmaking, and she would always sort of play, like, the quote-unquote plain girl next to Brigitte Bardot or whoever, but, like, she was in Shoot the Piano Player for Truffaut.
That's right. Yes.
She worked with Godard. She worked with Romare. She worked with Claude Chabrol, Jules Dassin, Julien Duvivier. Like, you know, for people who collect the Criterion Collection DVDs, like, chances are you've probably already seen her and not realized it. She was all over the place. And I think, like, maybe more than anyone else in the film, it's sort of her performance, actually, that kind of keeps me coming back to this film over and over again, that there's some dimension that you kind of brush up against but don't totally grasp. You know, I think, like, there's something almost sad or melancholic in her performance. You know, even when she's smiling, sometimes I think she looks sad.
I have that similar reaction. Her performance kind of reminded me of a Setsuko Hara performance. She's always smiling no matter what she's saying, you know.
That's a great comparison. I hadn't thought of that. I thought a little bit of also the actress in Itsumama Tambien.
Yeah.
There's something almost I'm sure I'm projecting a little bit because she died 2 days after her filming had finished on the picture. Mm. But there is something a little bit, fatalistic, I think, in her performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I know actor dies right after you finish filming, it's probably going to inform the editing process, which takes you might pick, how you might assemble it. I have to imagine that it somehow fed into the film, but I think that's a really great, complicated performance. And the way the film ends, over the course of the film, she sort of suggests that, she's called in sick for work and they think that she's frail and she doesn't actually get sick that often, so she's just calling in sick to be with him. So at the end, when he goes to call her at work, mm-hmm. and they say, oh, she's not in today, she's sick, his assumption is that, oh, she's off with another guy, she never really loved me, and that's I can completely understand jumping to that conclusion. That's a very
sure.
I think a young man kind of reaction. I think the equivalent today would be oh, she didn't text me back, she doesn't love me.
Mm-hmm.
hopefully I'm a little bit matured out of that, but I definitely understand that. But mm-hmm. I've watched the film many, many times, and the more I watch, the more I sort of feel maybe it's not the correct conclusion. And I'm glad that Melvin Ben Peebles left it sort of open-ended, because it kind of makes me want to break through some of these barriers and try and empathize with another person, which I think is what the film is all about. You don't know if maybe at the end she is really sick, or you just don't know. So yeah. I think it's a challenging film in a lot of respects, and I think it has this really great ending that I think I've sort of fixated on for...
Oh, the ending's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I did want to jump... I know we've now kind of transitioned into the movie, but just backtracking on who Melvin Van Peebles is, I did want to say one thing. It kind of goes back to him being overlooked. I mean, when you read, a lot of essays and just read up on, black film and, what kickstarted black film, again, a lot of times it's Cassavetes' Shadows and Shirley Clarke's early work. And even, Shirley Clarke, she lent John Cassavetes some of the equipment so that he could make Shadows. So I can see how those two filmmakers get a lot of credit for kind of jumpstarting the black film movement. But at the same time, Melvin Van Peebles being an actual black filmmaker, and I know Sweet Sweetback came out years after, Shadows and Shirley Clarke's, earlier work. But, I feel and this is partially from the perspective of my dad, who actually was alive, he was born in the mid-40s, so he was in his 20s when all this stuff was happening and whatnot. And, I just believe that a lot of black people got inspired when seeing Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, whereas, stuff like Shirley Clarke and early John Cassavetes, for the most part, that stuff was kind of screened more for, white intellectual Americans. It wasn't people in Harlem were, watching those films. Obviously, I'm sure, plenty of black people saw them, but I think it was really Melvin Van Peebles' work that really kind of inspired early black film writers, filmmakers. Well, not early, because they were making movies before him, but, the explosion of black exploitation, which, in a way led to other avenues for black filmmakers to tell stories. But I just think that that's, something that also gets kind of overlooked.
Even the depictions of black communities and the violence that came out of those black exploitation films, I think that's the kind of thing that Charles Burnett was maybe working against with films like Killer of Sheep, and especially My Brother's Wedding. So I think, you see the reactions and counter reactions, how it sort of expands the film culture. I think that's very important, whether it's influenced by imitation or influenced by response. I think those are equally valid. Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, it's an interesting film, and obviously, it's incredibly influential. It has sort of a strange legacy. I think if you actually watch the film, it's a frustrated intellectual's political polemic wrapped up in this exploitation package. But studios and a lot of other filmmakers, what they got out of it was, the exploitation part. So it's kind of a strange...
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's notable that you chose his debut feature as opposed to his most famous work as the one that you wanted to talk about.
I mean, there's something There's always something like inherently mean about saying that a filmmaker's first film is their best, but yeah. Like, I, you know, I feel that way. This is, I mean, it's also compared to, I think, his other films, like, I think it's his most gentle and his most open. Like, I think of the scene when the two first meet and like he kind of falls and breaks the sunglasses, and it's like that veneer of cool, it's mm-hmm. it's stripped away, and it's sort of the openness and honesty that, you know, lets them connect.
I also think too, like, even before Sweetback, what got Hollywood's attention was his second movie, you know, Watermelon Man. So this movie still, yeah, I side note, I do agree, you know, it's his most gentle, but like it's overlooked on various levels. Like, again, we're going to keep, you know, I'll try not to make this about Sweetback, but yeah, I guess that's like his most known film. But then even before that, Watermelon Man also got him on the map too. So it's like, it's easy for, with the mm-hmm. reputation of Watermelon Man and Sweetback, it's easy for a movie like Story of a Three-Day Pass to kind of get overlooked. You know what I mean?
Maybe we can talk about specific stylistic ways in which it differs from his other work. Obviously, we've touched on the French New Wave influence, but that sort of independent, low-budget, kind of DIY ethos, he utilized that in all of his films, right? That's just sort of like the mode that you have to operate in if you have limited financial constraints, mm-hmm. or if you have financial yeah. constraints. So, but nevertheless, there's something. Do you think that this work is derivative of, say, Godard, or is it does it stand on its own as this singular work?
A little bit of both. I don't think this movie would exist without, you know, French New Wave. But at the same time, it's one of those cases where it's not just like a blatant copy or a knockoff, because style-wise, there's a lot of French New Wave influence, obviously. But at the same time, the actual story, I don't see how a Truffaut or Godard could actually tell this story. Or if they did, it wouldn't be as genuine as a guy like Melvin Van Peebles telling the story. So, you know, it's a little bit of both. Yeah. It's very much his own film, but it still has some obvious influences, in my opinion, at least.
Like, I think if Truffaut or Godard made it, like, the Nicole Becher character would be the main character and he would be the other. And, like, I think...
Ah, good point, damn.
There's something so powerful about, you know, the second scene in the film. It's a point-of-view shot, and he puts you directly in his shoes. And, you know, you have that condescending captain just speaking right into his face. It's very powerful, I think, in a sort of understated way. You know, it's not preaching, it's just putting you in a position where you're kind of forced to empathize. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a lot of scenes where he leaves it a little bit open-ended but kind of leads you in the right direction. Like, there's the scene where he gets into a fight with the musician at the Spanish bar, you know, and she sort of doesn't totally understand.
Yeah,
you know, she's like, she said, well, you know, it was a compliment, and he said, well, yeah, how is that a compliment? It's just almost a throwaway line right at the end of the scene when they're kind of walking off, but I think it's just to nudge you a little bit in the right direction. So I think there's a lot of subtleties that I think a French filmmaker might not have had if they were to tell this same story.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think he falls in love with her?
Wow.
Yeah, it's sort of a weird, like, after that whole encounter, it's clear she doesn't understand, right? And yet he continues on with his happy weekend with her.
I think, do you want to go first, Marcus? Or I can.
Well, I don't know, I'm trying to think, yeah. So.
Sprung
you
that
might,
one
you
on
go
you.
First. Yeah.
I mean, personally, I think, like, there have been times in my life as a young man where I've been in situations where I don't necessarily speak the language well or at all. You know, you might not look like everyone else. You feel lonely. It's very alienating. I think, you know, of course, I'm not black, but I can definitely identify with this character as an outsider when he's sort of wandering around Paris and trying to kill time and maybe talk to girls or make a friend or mm-hmm. just sitting on the bench. Like, I've definitely been in those situations. And I think any kind of connection becomes very important in those situations. I think he falls in love with her because it's the sort of one connection he has in this period mm-hmm. of time that he has all to himself.
Yeah. Do you think that their connection is genuine, or is it just born out of circumstance? Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it might be a little bit of both.
And it's an ephemeral love, you know, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. You have a love that might only last 3 days, you know. I think that can be just as valid and important experience, and, you know, absolutely, be the one person when you need it. But, you know, it actually kind of reminded me a little bit of the Before Sunrise movies, like, you know, they sort of...
Oh, definitely. Damn, I didn't even think about that.
It's like very similar. Even like To the Wonder is sort of a similar type of story. The American and the French woman falling in love, and they sort of go through this location, and it's sort of a fleeting love, and, you know, it has that bittersweet quality that I think
which is based on a true story too, like Malick's real experience.
I had a friend who pointed out to me that, like, my two favorite American directed films, it's like this and The New World, they don't seem like they have a lot in common, but she said, like, oh, they're both films directed by these, like, French-speaking Americans who lived in France, and they're both about, like, interracial love stories about, like, Americans going to Europe, and I don't know, like, I'm not introspective enough to give a good answer why that's it speaks to me, but it does, I guess.
I think, we can all guess. We'll all just psychoanalyze you. Yeah, I mean, I think there's is an extent that Van Peebles kind of undercuts the love story, especially with the sex scenes, or the, I guess they're not exactly sex scenes, but they're, whatever, the love scenes, where you kind of, you get it in, like, we're talking about perspective and subjectivity, like, we get shots, quick cuts of what's going on inside their head and their fantasies, and her fantasy is a little strange. It's essentially... out on the bush being kidnapped by tribesmen and put on an altar, and he's there to, I guess, take advantage of her. I don't know.
Now that scene in particular, I don't know if this is a criticism or not, but I think that specific scene on some level is Melvin Van Peebles kind of like projecting his own thoughts of what maybe, you know, white women, specifically foreign white women, might think of black men. Like, again, we've already talked about, there's a naivete to, like, her issues with race, and part of that's just because, you know, there's people of color in France, but not to the extent of, say, in America. So it's, yeah, she doesn't get it, but I do feel like, I mean, you see it a lot of times today, like, where black people just assume, like, oh, you just think black people are all this. So that scene, which is, it's an interesting scene, but I think that that's definitely, like, Melvin Van Peebles projecting his own, like, well, he does that a lot, you know, in his films, but that's kind of like a highlight of him, like, I think making an assumption of, I think that scene goes beyond just that movie.
That's fair. But it, nevertheless, it does kind of call into question what her motives are, well, as you say, Martin, the romance may be ephemeral. That's kind of the one of the first clues we get that maybe this isn't a love for the ages, you know, but I guess that's true of whenever, with every human encounter, like, we all have this interior life, and, like, the way that we relate to someone may not be exactly the way they would like, you know.
I mean, it's bold even just to acknowledge that people have these inner fantasies that might go beyond seeing somebody else as another person, the way we might fetishize one another, you know. It's not an easy thing to talk about, even if it is it does come across more like his own projections. I mean, there's times too where, like, you know, I think, like, there is maybe a separation between how the characters view each other and how the film has us see them, even though it's a very subjective experience watching it. Like, there's moments where, you know, she's talking in the car and you get cuts to the point of view shots of, like, her legs, and the music, there's a music that comes in over top of the actual film soundtrack, and to me it's almost like you're getting a break from the film's perspective into the American's perspective, and it's like she's talking away and he's just trying to get a look at her legs, you know. There's moments like that where, you know, I think it's, you know, maybe a little bit embarrassing, but it's sort of honest in the ways that people might overlook pure empathy, I guess. You know, or sexuality might distract from that.
Let's talk about the film's tone. We've talked about, like, some of the instances that are kind of, I think they're meant to be comic, right? Like, I think we're supposed to laugh when he has his fantasy about living in his big palace on in the French countryside, you know, and some of his conversations he has in the mirror, and like just a lot of his encounters are really humorous. And there's, but as we say, there's this underlying sadness to the film. First of all, there's the isolation of just wandering around by yourself, longing for human contact, and like making a connection where there may or may not be a real connection. But how does he balance that tone? And does, I mean, like, do the comedic elements kind of help? Are they, do they help underline the points of the film, or are they kind of distracting? What do you guys think?
What's the Charlie Chaplin quote about life is a tragedy in close up and a comedy in long shot, or the other way around? I sort of feel a little bit like that. Like, you know, sometimes looking at these things on a microcosm or macrocosm, it might be funny, but there's like an underlying cruelty or sadness to a lot of these situations or encounters or moments. I mean, some of it, like the captain, it, like, he almost feels like he's out of like maybe a John Waters film, or like he made me think of like the uncle in Harold and Maude. Like, it's that kind of a performance where it's like, you know, it's funny, but like it's also just racist and horrible. Yeah. Like, I mean that's another thing too. Like, a lot of the racism in the film, like, I think especially when you look at other movies made in 1960s, there's the racism very explicit. It's people using slurs, using violence. What I think, like, sort of I find interesting about the racism in the film is that it's more implicit. Like, everything the captain says sounds, you know, at first glance, maybe polite and correct. You know, he never says anything wrong, right? You know, when he's saying, you know, I can trust you. And even at the end, you know, you had those three soldiers sort of report back what they saw when they ran into him at the beach. You know, but the captain, like, what he punishes him for is that the supposedly going out of like the regular distance, but gives him like a many days suspension or whatever, and he loses his promotion. Like, you know what it's for, but he doesn't say it. And like the hotel motel keeper, innkeeper, like, you know, never says anything, but like, you know, it's racist. Yeah, and like, I think maybe today in the world we're living in, like, nine times out of ten, I think, like, that's the kind of racism you run into today, or at least, you know, I think maybe.
Right. No, that's true. I mean, yeah, that's what, you know, we all have relatives who may not be as woke as we'd like them to be. So trying to explain contemporary racism in where, well, at least where I live in Los Angeles, like the ways in which people are privileged and other people are not, it's tough to quantify because it's not snarling Southern people with Confederate flags on their trucks. Right, it's like, yeah, it's just daily encounters where you just, things don't feel right, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, and that, this film does a great job of illustrating that. And it's sort of more a comedy of manners. At least it's like a comedy of manners, but it's not funny. It's like really painful, you know? And it's painful that, like, you know, this still happens.
Oh, absolutely. What you just said too about explaining to certain people about, you know, contemporary or like racism today, it's interesting too, because, you know, for 2 years I actually lived in the same house as my grandmother, and it's interesting. It's not even just like a white thing. Like, from, I remember just living with her, you know, she was in her 90s at the time. She was 90, 91, 92. And just learning certain things about her, like certain, like, vernaculars, like her saying, you know, Oriental.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I would be like, no, Grandma, it's Asian. Or, you know, like, you know, like, a rug is Oriental. And but, like, her kind of just, like, whatever. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm 91. Yeah. Like, what
that
does it
is
matter?
Very,
but, you know, it's such a generational thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Similar experience. That's bold of you to try and correct. Like, I just, when my grandpa says Oriental, I just go, okay, grandpa.
Yeah. Well, my thing is, I can't help it, because where I grew up, like, Amherst is very much, it's like super, Amherst, Massachusetts is very, very PC. And it's just, you know, when you've been there for, you know, since you were 7, a lot of that stuff is embedded. So it's like, I can't help but, you know,
yeah,
certain things, you know, like bother, whether it's like homophobia or, you know, like the wrong terminology, things like that. It's just very like, you just have to say something, even if it's my grandmother and she just kind of blows me off, like, yeah, whatever. You know.
Yeah, grandma ain't changing now. that ship has sailed.
No, nope.
But
also with Human Contact, I think we need the lead actor guy. I keep forgetting his name. His performance, especially in terms of like Human Contact, I forgot what's the scene. He's sitting on a park bench, and someone's about to like engage with him, but then they walk away, and it's this total vulnerable thing where he's just like, are you gonna talk to me? And then like they walk away, and then he just kind of sits back very defeated. Mm-hmm. It's very like his mannerism, he has a lot of, you know, he's kind of an unpolished actor.
Yeah,
and I don't mean to say that negatively, but I think it helps in this film where it's true, just he seems very desperate to, you know,
I mean, there's a
make contact and stuff.
Earnestness, you know. Like one of my favorite moments is
Ernest.
Like
yes,
when when he finds out that like his reprimand's been removed, and he starts running to the phone booth, and he just breaks into that smile in the camera, like he's trying to keep up with it. You feel his enthusiasm, even though like there's times when his accent kind of slips, and like it's not, like you said, a polished performance. Like I know Melvin Van Peebles said sort of about his filmmaking in general that it's fun sometimes to let the ragged edges show so that people can think and feel and understand, you know, which is a quote I think about
100%. Yeah, for those listening who aren't familiar with Melvin Van Peebles' work, that is a common thing in quite a few of his films, like where certain errors or certain things, like he'll let it show. Like, so what Martin just said is 100% true, not just for Story for 3 Day Pass, but a lot of it. Like, you'll see, like, in the background of like, Sweetback, like, people, like, will trip, mm-hmm, kind of, like, you know, out of frame, like, when there's a big crowd shot or something, but, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so I think we're about winding down, but just really quickly, I hesitate to kind of pit his films against each other, but maybe you guys can make the case for why this one is the most significant of his work, or at least maybe not significant, but the one that people should really revisit. Kind of just a summation.
Martin, you wanna?
Sure. I guess this is the one that I get the most out of. It's the film that broke him into Hollywood in the first place. It's, you know, made a big splash at the San Francisco Film Festival. And I think it's a film that, even though some people have seen and found out, never really made the impact that it should have in America. I think the American wide release, it was cut down by 20 minutes. They cut it down to 67 minutes, and it's not a long film. It's,
yeah,
like, you know, and I'm not sure what was chopped out exactly, but and you read the reviews from the time period when it came out, and they break your heart. Even the enthusiastic ones, like, there's, you know, some of them are so mean.
Yeah. It's so disappointing because, yeah, the Renetta Adler one, so sad. Yeah.
Well, you know, like, I think that one in particular, it's like, oh, like a black man and middle-aged French woman, who'd want to see that?
Yeah.
You know, and it's a positive review.
I know.
You know. So I think, like, it's a precious film that, like, I think people just, a lot of people haven't really discovered yet, and this should be like a classic, like a real classic. And it's influential, like you mentioned at the beginning, the Spike Lee, you know, who's of course represented on the Sight and Sound list. Like, so much of his style comes very specifically from this film, you know, the Spike Lee signature shot, like you mentioned, that's the, you know, coming into the bar when the actor and the camera are in the same dollies, they're moving together. That's all over Spike Lee's body of work. Or even like 25th Hour, talking into the mirror and the mirror's talking back and he's not moving.
Yeah.
Like, that's from this film. And it's such a stylish, sensitive work that I think, you know, everyone should see it. I think this should be an important film. It is important to me, and people need to see it.
All right. I like that.
Yeah, I also, and I think it needed to be seen too, just because it's not the earliest. I hate saying early because it is, you know, there's Oscar Michaud, mm-hmm, and plenty,
yeah,
of people, you know, since, but just, you know, It's two things. It's a story of racism, or what race, sorry, it's not just racism, but the story of race, you know, told from the perspective of a black male, you know, but in Europe, you know, there are layers to it. And, you know, I hesitate to say ahead of its time, but even today, there's not many movies like it.
No.
Yeah.
And like, you know, Martin was just saying earlier, it doesn't just, you know, branch off to Spike Lee. I mean, we mentioned earlier, like, the black and white rawness that we see in, say, you know, Killer Sheep is, you know, is found in Story of a Few-Day Past as well. Like, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, for a guy like Charles Burnett to study at UCLA, I wouldn't be surprised if they, if he had never had a, you know, special screening of Story of a Few-Day Past during his, you know, his film studies, you know? So, you know, so it branches off to a lot of potential influences on other filmmakers, you know, as well. Mm-hmm. And also, and like Charles Burnett too, I'm also, like, good filmmakers don't always just make one movie. So I've always been, it inspired me back in April to do that big piece on Charles Burnett, because still, it's always Killer of Sheep, Killer of Sheep, Killer of Sheep. And that's a good movie. It's a great movie, but he has other great movies. Just like Melvin Van Peebles, it's like, you know, to a lot of people, it's either Sweetback or, you know, he's also a quietly, he never gets labeled as a character actor. But I think he's a good character actor as well. Like, outside of his own movies, he's been acting, you know, for a very long time. And again, it's not just Sweetback. He has other great stuff that needs to be, you know, seen, revisited, or seen for the first time. And this is the perfect example. I mean, start from the beginning. It's always great when you can start at the beginning of a filmmaker's, you know, body of work.
Yeah.
So
I think that's a good place to call it. So yeah, revisit this. I guess. I guess we can put it to a vote. Martin, I'm assuming yours is a yes.
Please, for the love of God, watch this movie.
Watch the movie! Marcus, watch the movie?
Oh, one absolutely. I'm going to say, I mean, it is a yes on a long list.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean for that to sound like a backhanded insult. But regardless, yes, no matter how, what way you cut it, yes.
Yes, okay.
I'm giving it a yes.
All right, watch the movie. And again, I had never seen it, and I'm really grateful that Martin nudged me into this. It was like a real treat to watch, honestly. Cool. Yeah.
Oh, great.
And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, have you seen Story of a Three-Day Pass? Come tell us what you think on our website, flickswise.com, or you can like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/flickswise. And of course, for a more immediate response, you should probably follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, go to iTunes, rate us, and leave us a nice comment. That'll make you cooler than a Parisian in sunglasses in my book. On our next show, we're back to the Sight and Sound list with Fritz Lang's 1931 thriller, M. Until then, Martin, thanks so much for presenting Story of a Three-Day Pass for us.
That was cathartic. Thank you.
Yes. It finally happened. And let this, just a word for all of you who have submitted FlixWise Favors submissions. I will eventually get to it. It just might take a while. But I acknowledge you. You have been seen. I will get to you. Fear not. Anyway, Marcus, thank you
yes.
so much for joining us on this adventure.
Thank you for having me. I always love being on this podcast. I love listening even when I'm not on it.
All right, cool. I guess it's back to the barracks for us. All right.